Herzlich willkommen zu Klassik Viral, dem Podcast gegen den Corona-Blues. Mein Name ist Arndt Kobbers und ich freue mich sehr über meinen heutigen Gast, den Pianisten Jonathan Powell. Ich habe gehört, I've heard you speak German quite well, but better English, and we should
not
switch
well.
To English.
German is like my fifth language, and I'm a beginner.
All right.
So maybe English would be...
Okay, I'll try.
Thank you.
Yeah. You don't live in Berlin, you're British, you don't live in Berlin, and I thought you would live in England, but now I've heard you don't live in England, you live in Poland, and you come from Poland right now.
Yeah, exactly. I live in the very south of Poland, south of Kraków, in the Carpathian uh-huh. Mountains, and we can see the High Tatry, Wysokie Tatry Mountains from our house, and I ended up living in Poland because I have a Polish wife, Irena, and we thought we would just like try. I come to Poland, see what happens, and it turns out I can handle it. That's where we live. And initially we lived in Gliwice, and as we started having children, we realized that our flat was far too small. And we bought this house in the mountains. It's not even in a village. There's like one village one side of the hill, another village the other side of the hill. And on the top of the hill, there are about 40 people living there. And for the first time in my life, I can practice the piano without having war with the neighbors. So this is actually a really excellent place to live if you're a pianist.
All right. And the animals from the woods come to listen.
Yeah. We have deer in the garden. Sometimes there are wild boars walking around.
Wow.
I've not seen the wild boars, but you can see where they've been digging.
Mm-hmm.
And all our neighbors' animals come to our garden because the farmers are quite sort of relaxed attitude. And so their cows are meant to be tethered, but they often release themselves from their place mm-hmm. and have a nice walk. And we've had sheep actually destroy our front door by going doof. And chickens in the garden. So yeah, we get quite a lot of animals. Oh. And we have lots of animals. We have three cats, including one who just saw our house. I think he saw my wife and knew that she was like this kind of cat lady and decided he would live here. And dog, who we met one day on a walk, and then he just waited by our front door until we let him in.
Hmm.
So we have quite a lot of animals as well.
All right. And now you are in Berlin. You came to Berlin to record a new CD. That means you have recorded it a week ago or 2 weeks ago?
Last week.
It was last week.
On Thursday.
All right, yeah. Because I was not in Berlin. We were supposed to meet here.
But it's quite happy
that it works today. So you have recorded. Do you do a last recording now, today, or is it just
no,
to listen
I
to
was,
it?
No, I did the recording on Thursday. Then I went to Denmark to do a concert, an actual concert.
Wow.
That was fantastic. And I could meet some old friends from Denmark there, and today I'm just in Berlin because I go back via Berlin.
Right. All right.
I get the train to Krakow this evening.
All right. But still, tell me something, please, about what you have recorded. It's a piano concerto by Hans Winterberg, who's
exactly.
quite an interesting guy.
Yeah.
Interesting music.
And I think his story is very symbolic of the, you know, difficulties of the 20th century and to do with identity and to do with nationality, because he was a Jew from Prague and was a student of the Czech quarter tone man. Who is that?
Oh, Alois Haber.
Yes, exactly. Who, in fact, Haber started writing music in a rather Germanic expressionist way and then, went on his own path. And his students, I think, included Victor Ullmann, Pavel Haas, Gideon Klein, who, along with Winterberg, were all imprisoned in Terezin. And remarkably, Winterberg survived this experience and lived to tell the tale, although his story thereafter became even more complicated, because he was, it's a very complicated story, and he realized that his wife had taken his manuscripts to Germany, and she lived in the area south of Munich. Mm-hmm. So he managed to leave communist Czechoslovakia to go and get his manuscripts. And when he was there, he was not recognized as a Czech nor as a German. And you can imagine the kind of situation he found himself in.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some small recognition of his music because he had a good contact in Munich radio, who organized some performances of his music. But, of course, this was the 50s, 60s, and by then his music was completely from another era. This is the era when, you could hear Momenta at Donau Eschingen, and Hans Winterberg wrote in this sort of style, which you can relate to sort of Janáček or Martinů.
Mm.
So, he was in suspended animation,
mm-hmm.
I think. And then something very strange happened, which you will have to read Michael Haas's website, Entat the Musik, which explains this properly, because I don't know if I can do it justice, but somehow his music ended up, the scores, the manuscripts, etc., in an archive of Sudeten composers, and he was not even from Sudeten.
Mm-hmm.
He was from Prague, and he was not a Sudeten German. He was a Czech Jew who also spoke German. And for some reason or other, there was a veto on accessing the manuscripts for a very, very long time. And fortunately, Michael Haas and the Exil Arte Foundation in Vienna took these guys to court and won.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have access to this music. And, the rest follows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Please.
But you are editing now some works, or at least this piano concerto.
I made
Boosey and Hawkes. Boosey and Hawkes will publish it, or has published it, I don't know.
It's, in the pipeline,
right,
as it were.
Yeah. But how did you get into this project, and how comes that you edit this?
Well, I've known Michael Haas from Exil Arte about 15 years or something, because he used to be the director of the Judische Museum in Vienna. And he invited me with this mezzo-soprano Laurie Lixenberg to do a concert there once. So we turned up and she sang Hans Eisler and some other stuff. And I got to know Michael, and we were chatting about all sorts of stuff, and he realised that I was, you know, interested in quite a lot of stuff that he was interested in, so we stayed in touch. And when Vinterberg's music had this sort of amazing moment when it became public again, I was one of the people he thought about, you know, to start doing something with it. And then at the end of last year, my agent, Peter Puskas, was in touch with Michael, and we were discussing various ways that we could arrange a recording of piano concertos. And the Deutsche Radio Berlin had to cancel a session because the orchestra would have been too big for Corona times. And so initially, we suddenly had this deadline of like end of January to record the first piano concerto. So I thought, well, I better edit it myself, because then I will learn the piece as I edit it. And I've had, you know, quite a bit of experience doing this, so it wouldn't have been the first time. Of course, that one got postponed until end of June. And, yeah, that here we are.
All right.
But it was, you know, in my Christmas was very Vinterberg-y. Vinterbergish.
Mm-hmm. And is the music worth the effort to deal with and to play it?
Well,
I've never heard it, because no one has ever heard
exactly.
this concerto.
This is the point. I think it is, and the fact that I can say it's not quite like anything else, I think, proves the point. You can hear that it's definitely of its time, 40s, mm-hmm. this particular piece. Although to make a direct comparison with other composers is actually rather difficult. And I think merely by dint of that, it makes it worth hearing. And it's incredibly economical. Mm-hmm. There are tons of notes, which is a paradox. Extremely clear textures. And rather sort of post-Ravel orchestration. Mm-hmm. And yet it's highly chromatic. And at the same time, you can hear very clear tonal harmony, and if not tonal functional harmony, then at least centers of tonality being played against each other. Mm-hmm. So rather like his life story, the music itself is slightly paradoxical.
Mm-hmm. With melodies as well?
It's interesting. It's an extremely compact concerto. The whole piece lasts 15 minutes and there are three movements.
Wow.
The first movement is a kind of moto perpetuo for the pianist, and yet the orchestra has rather long lines, and only towards the end of the movement do you hear this rather luxurious melody. So it is constantly hinted at before, mm-hmm. and yet is only revealed at the end of the movement. The second movement does have a rather clear but very simple melodic content, and it reminds me rather of Bartok, slow movements mm-hmm. and a kind of dirge with isorhythmic material. And the third movement is very lively and a kind of humoresque capriccio type of thing. And half of the last movement is actually a piano cadenza. So the orchestra were very pleased about that because they could go home and leave me to it.
I read yesterday that Hans Winterberg died quite old, with 90 years old, 1991.
Yeah.
Did he compose a lot after the Second World War?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, he kept on composing all the piano concertos, of which there are four, mm-hmm. date from his years in Bavaria.
Oh, right.
And the last one was written in the 70s, I think, but mm-hmm. you might have to check mm-hmm. that.
Were they performed in that time?
The one, two, and three were, but they were apparently radio performances where people got the music just before the performance, so they might have been slightly compromised by mm-hmm. this fact. And I've heard the recordings, and yeah, they needed more time.
All right. So there's more work for you to do about Winterberg.
Well, if people like what I did this time, then yes.
Uh-huh. And it's not only this one piece that's really interesting, but there's more to discover in this.
Exactly, yes. Yes, and my friend Christophe Sirodeau, who's a French pianist and composer, he recently recorded violin and piano sonata, and he will record cello and piano music with Adele Bitter, mm-hmm. who is in Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we all had a very nice evening with Adele and Frank Harders from Boosey and Peter Kreitmeier, who is Winterberg's grandson.
Uh-huh. Adele Bitter, I think, is the wife of Holger Groschop. I'm going to meet him tomorrow.
You're right, okay.
The pianist. So the links get together.
I was in their flat, but I think he was not there.
All right. Uh-huh. He's coming to visit me tomorrow for the next podcast. And when is the CD to be published? Next year?
I don't know.
Uh-huh.
It will be Capriccio.
All right.
But it's out of my hands.
Mm-hmm.
As it were.
Yeah. Well, you've studied piano, but you studied musicology as well, I read.
Yeah.
And you do composing, but self-taught.
On and off, yes.
Which is not a problem, but...
Well, it was sort of self-taught, but I had some good lessons from Alexander Gurr.
Oh, yeah.
I went to study in Cambridge to do a music degree. And in the UK, music degree is a kind of rather nebulous concept. And in this case, it involved, you know, obviously lots of music history, analysis, ethnomusicology. And in the third year, I had some sessions with Sandy, as we called him, Alexander Gurr, who is the son of Walter, who was Schoenberg's mm-hmm. friend here in Berlin. And looking back, those sessions with Sandy were very interesting because the three people who chose to study with him were a conductor, David Robert Coleman,
mm-hmm.
who is working here, and the pianist Nick Hodges, who is very established in Germany, mm-hmm. and me. And we were all very different. And yet, you didn't go many times. You went like six times in the year. So that is my sort of, you know, because I've since seen how people study composition these days, and you don't go six times in the year.
Mm-hmm.
It's rather more intense, let's say. So I did study composition a bit with Sandy, whose music I will record later this year, I hope.
All right. Yeah, you have a very broad repertoire from Bach about Beethoven, Liszt, and whatever, and Albéniz you play, and Messiaen, and Stockhausen, Xenakis until today.
Yeah.
But I have the feeling there's a focus on 20th century, first half 20th century even, and a focus on Eastern European or Russian music. It's something of interest. And I read this repertoire list, and there are quite a lot of names of composers I've never heard of, or just once or twice or so, but I don't really know what music that is.
You have to look them up sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. But how comes that you play this Goldenweiser, Felix Blumenfeld, Alexander Krein, Egon Kornaut? Never heard. There's quite a lot of names. How come that you're interested in this field?
Because I went to Cambridge, and it's not like getting a degree as a performer. You don't have tuition as a pianist. I had to later find a teacher, and the teacher I found, actually with the help of Nick Hodges, he always used to say, Jonathan, when are you going to do something about your piano playing? And so he gave me the phone number of a lady called Sulamita Aronofsky, who lived in North London. I shouldn't talk about her in the past because she still, last time I checked, age 92, does live in North London. She was a student of Goldenweiser and Grigory Ginsburg and Abraham Schatzkes, who was a great Mettner player. But already I was very deeply into this repertoire, because after I did my degree, I decided I would do a PhD, and I wrote about the influence of Scriabin in the period, 1910, when he was still alive, until about 1930, when socialist realism started kicking in. So I discovered, I researched and played the music of people like Stanchinsky, Samuel Feinberg, Alexander Krein, all these figures of the 1910s and 20s who in Russia were writing sort of post-romantic, modernist, or very modern music. So it seemed at the time that Sulamita would be a very obvious person to go to. And given her background, she's amazingly tolerant of and capable of coaching and advising people with a very diverse repertoire. I remember Nick was playing sort of Stockhausen, Nono, and Beethoven, and Haydn, and Debussy to her, and I thought maybe this is a person I could get some valuable advice, and she completely transformed my piano playing, and it was a bit rotten before, and then it got better, basically. And I spent years helping her out, because this was part of our deal, like being her orchestra when her students were playing concertos, and she would occasionally ask me to teach her students. But she would go in her kitchen and listen, and then come out saying, you said exactly what I would say.
Good sign.
I thought, thank God for that.
So, and in dealing with this PhD with Scriabin and the people around him, you got into searching new composers or forgotten composers and new works and all this. There's quite a lot of to discover, isn't it?
Yeah. For example, about the first recording I ever made was the piano sonata of Alexander Krein, or Krein. And I discover that it was not only played by its dedicatee, Neuhaus, but also by Goldenweiser and by Yelena Beckmann-Scherbina, who had given the first performance of, say, Scriabin number 6 and was a friend of Scriabin. So these were pieces that were, at the time, highly rated by people we still know about. And it leads one to think that, you know, if people like that thought they were worth learning, and they take some learning, mm-hmm. then maybe we should be taking a look at them as well today.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the composers you dig deep into is Sorabchi, Kai Khosrou Sorabchi.
Yeah.
He's a very interesting figure, a legendary figure. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit more about him? Why should music lovers know him and his music?
Well, I think one of the things that makes him remarkable is that he was a half-Indian gay man in 1920s Britain in London, and he absolutely was determined to be himself. He would not compromise in any way. And when you hear the music he was writing in the 20s, you know, when he was a young man, and compare it to other British music, or indeed any other music, it's utterly remarkable. It sounds like he's landed from another planet. There are obvious points of reference with the music that he really admired, like the middle period Szymanowski, the atonal but not serial Schoenberg, etc., etc. One could go on. But what he was doing then was extremely bold, and that was when he was still sort of in the public eye. And after a bit, he sort of withdrew from the public eye but carried on writing.
Mm-hmm. He didn't have to work. He got money from his father, so he could really concentrate on composing and doing music or so. And did the music he wanted to. And then really for 40 years or so, he banned his music from being performed in public.
Yeah,
Is there a reason why he did that?
Oh, absolutely. He there was a performance in London of just one section of a piano piece he wrote. And it took like two or three times longer than it should be and was complete. You know, it was an unbelievably sort of appalling, humiliating experience. And he said, well, if people aren't ready to play it, then we need to wait until they are.
Uh-huh.
Of course, this has happened with a lot of other repertoire that...
But normally for composers or for artists in general, there's a sort of a correction or whatever. You get something back from the audience if this is good what you do, or if it reaches the people. He didn't get that. He was going on composing for no one.
I think the early 30s or the late, no, it was probably the late 20s still, he did a broadcast of a piano piece on BBC radio, and somehow Frederick Delius in France heard it and wrote to him and said how wonderful he thought it was. And he had, you know, supporters like Alban Berg a little bit, and you know, just a few others, and that was enough to keep him going, I think. Oh, right. To know that he was on his right track. Yeah. And didn't need some massive support or public, mm-hmm. but he needed to just keep going.
And he composed nearly only for piano solo, or did he compose other pieces? And his pieces got longer and longer and longer.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
Although there are lots of short pieces as well.
Really, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I read that he had some piano symphonies. The number 6 piano symphony is 4.5 hours.
No, it's longer.
It's longer.
Yeah, it's 6 hours. I gave the world premiere.
All right. And this Opus Clavicembalisticum is 4 hours?
4.5.
Four and a half. And you, I read that you performed that more than 10 times, maybe.
Yeah, many times.
How is that? How is that to perform such a piece? And how with intermissions?
Last time, I think I had one.
Wow.
Although before, we might have had two.
So it's 2 hours nonstop, and then intermission, 2 hours nonstop.
Yeah. But then people go to Gotterdammerung, don't they?
Yeah, that's right. But there's something happening on stage, and there's...
But I'm on stage.
That's true.
I'm doing stuff. They can watch me if they get bored.
Yeah, that's true. But you have to play. You can't do so many curious things. And
I hope I don't.
But how is it? How do you survive such an evening? Even more, this Sequentia Cyclica, mm-hmm. which is about 8 hours than 8 hours. Did you perform this
several
live?
Times?
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I know that you recorded it now on seven CDs.
Yeah.
Which has come out last year.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and in how is this on a live performance? In one piece, in one evening or one day?
Day. Really? Although I used to do it in one, you know, thing with two intervals. Although I've revised my attitude, and next time I will do it, we're going to do it over 3 days with five concerts. So, and also, you know, the theme is very well known.
So it's sort of easy listening, Sorabchi, then.
Yeah, the theme is very well known. It's not like people are going to forget what the deal is.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the most well-known themes in Western music, so mm-hmm. I don't think the thread will be lost.
Mm-hmm. But what is the idea behind it? Why do you need, as a composer, 8 hours or more to get over your ideas to the public?
Why? I would say, why not? I would turn it around. One reason, I think, is that he wanted to have a complete range of movement sizes. Some are 2 minutes, some are 70 minutes. But if you just have one 70-minute movement in a structure, it will dominate it
mm-hmm.
and become disproportionate. So you need to have more than one.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, he has three movements that are that kind of length. And there are several movements that are like 3 or 4 minutes, others, you know, all the way in between. And there were 27 movements mm-hmm. in total. So by the time you add all of that up, it does become quite a long piece.
Mm-hmm. But how do you hold up your concentration? About 10 hours playing. It's 8 hours, sorry, 8 hours
yeah.
playing.
How? I think you kind of get used to it.
Do you get into sort of a trance or whatever? But you can't, as an audience or so, you can get into, I don't know, other dimensions. But as a performer, you have to be concentrated and you have to stick to what you do there.
Yeah, you do. But actually, I mean, you know, if you're like practicing really hard for some concerts, you sit at your piano for quite a few hours in the day. And this isn't so different. But it is quite demanding, yes. This is why I look forward to doing it over 3 days next year. I was meant to do it in April this year in Heidelberg.
Mm-hmm.
And of course didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but don't you sometimes think if you do, a Beethoven sonata, it's the same concert, you got the same money, and only after half an hour it's finished, or the concert after 1.5 hours.
Mm.
So you sit there for 8 hours doing the Sorabchi.
Well, you know, I think these things are like mountains. And there's something in me that sees them and think, because it is there, I want to do it.
And also, I mean, we won't find out what this music is like unless someone plays it properly. If no one does, it will just be this imaginary object. And it's a great pleasure to bring an imaginary object into reality. Because I read about Sarabji when I was 13 or 14 and saw this list of these pieces and got in touch with him and then his friend and executor, Alistair Hinton. And I would chat with Alistair about, say, what's this piece like? What's that piece like? And I remember saying, what's Sequentia Cyclica like? Because I just saw this name. And he said, oh, my word, that's a really big one. However, Sarabji thought it was his best piece. So after, you know, trying some smaller ones in my 20s and 30s and making some recordings, it's extremely gratifying for me and the composer, in a way, although he's dead, that it's this recording that has excited so much interest in his work, because he did actually think it was his best piece.
Mm-hmm. But you never get to know him personally.
I never met him, no. We wrote to each other a couple of times when I was a teenager.
All right.
And he had this reputation for being very sort of difficult and grumpy and not terribly sociable. Mm-hmm. And yet he replied incredibly graciously to a teenager's sort of fan letter.
Uh-huh.
So I wonder where all of that reputation came from.
And is it true that you put this the manuscripts into print, into printable version, at least from this Sequentia Cyclica?
Not for that piece. Oh. But I've done other pieces of Sarabji. I've typeset and edited.
All right.
Because you can't play from manuscript. It would be terrible.
Uh-huh. But it's just for you? Is it really pianists in the world who buy this course and learn these pieces? Are there some people who really play Sarabji?
I know a few.
Uh-huh. So there are still some pieces by Sarabji that are not performed yet?
Yeah.
All right.
A few. Not many, but a few.
All right.
But, you know, there are people who have this kind of interest in these long projects. Because, you know, I decided I would learn Schumann Humoresque. And a few months later, I can kind of play it. But with these pieces, it's a much longer game. So you just have to have different expectations.
Yeah. Well, they sound at least like they are not easy to play.
Not very.
It's quite virtuoso in music.
Yeah. You have your work cut out. But it's a kind of, like anything, I mean, you get to know how he does stuff and you find ways to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So what was difficult when you first started doing it becomes something that you can deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And like anything else, you know, you can just do it wrong because you're not on form or paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. And if someone now, some listener or someone says, well, Sarabji, that sounds interesting, I should give it a try and listen to it, what would you recommend as for a beginning?
There's a very nice recording by Yonti Solomon of Le Jardin Parfumé, which is a nocturne from the 20s. There's another very nice recording by Marc-André Hamelin of his first piano sonata. There are different recordings, including one by me, of his nocturne Gulistan. You know, these are sort of shorter, under half hour and under.
All right.
Uh-huh. Pieces. There's a very nice piece called Passeggiata Veneziana, based on the barcarolle from the Tales of Hoffmann. You know, there are lots of lighter, shorter pieces that are not, don't take up your whole day, for example.
But if you want to listen to and get into this Sequentia Cyclica, would you recommend to pick up some movements out there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or would you recommend reserve one day or one night and just get into it and listen to all these seven CDs?
I would I would think both approaches are you know, completely worthwhile. Although, you know, if you want to hear just one movement, there's one called Quasi Debussy. I can't remember which variation it is, which is a very, as the name suggests, post-impressionist bit of piano music. There are a lot of short variations that will give a very positive impression, I think. And then, you know, then when you feel ready, go and listen to a big one. There's a Passacaglia with 100 variations. There's a choral prelude that is the size of Mahler's Second Symphony. It's, I think people slightly obsess about the duration thing, although in a way that's not unexpected, but for me that's not the most interesting thing about this. Although, of course, when you compare it to other music, it does present itself as a thing.
I mean, it's not easy to compose a piece of, I don't know, 60, 70 minutes that does not hang through or does not leave the tension.
Yeah, yeah. Well, some people might say Sarabji failed in this, but others would say he succeeded. It's a rather subjective issue, isn't it?
And how is life going on for you now after this the concert in Copenhagen? In the next months, are there more concerts now?
It was in a place called Saxkirbing, which is like a village or small town. And it was very nice because ages ago, the organist in the church there, he's a really big fan of the music of Charles Tournemire. And he was doing like a cycle of Tournemire's organ music and invited other organists to come because it was Tournemire's 150th anniversary last year. But he wanted a pianist who could play the 12 prelude poèmes, which is a late piece of Tournemire, and it's a very interesting piece because it's a cycle of pieces which include titles like Méditation sur la Sainte Trinité. So who does this remind you of? His student Messiaen. And he is a real link between, say, late Debussy and Messiaen. And apparently, according to Flemming Hansen, who organized the concert, this was the fifth date we had arranged to do this. And we managed. And it was my first, like, real concert. And I was so pleased.
Yeah.
It was a really antique Danish piano. So it was slightly unusual instrument, but you know, apparently, well, people said that I could get a very nice sound from it, so that's good. And then I will go home now today, and then in a week and a bit I will play Iberia in the Musiksalon Schorfheider, which is this conductor David Robert Coleman, who lives in Joachimsthal. And he's established this series. And like everything else, this is like after many attempts, we are going to have this. So I will play Iberia, but twice in one evening.
So which could, is something.
It could be quite hardcore. And then I will go to the south of France and play Iberia in Pau, which is like scarily close to Spain for playing Iberia. But actually, I played Navarra, which is a piece from the time of Iberia, and my Spanish friend composer Gabriel Ecoreca said, you played it like one of these really old Spanish guys. So I thought, okay, I finally found the correct idiom.
Could you use the time now for the corona time at home to compose some pieces?
Yeah. Actually, last year I wrote, is it 8 or 10 piano pieces? I think it's 10 piano pieces. Some of them are okay. Some of them, I think, are less okay. They're meant to be a kind of partita for the 50th birthday of my friend Christophe Sirodeau. And he accepted them, so that's not bad. And then this year, I started off composing again, because last year it started writing one small piece for my wife's birthday. This year I started one small piece for my wife's birthday, and it was sort of okay. But I doubt myself as a composer. I think partly because if you spend your time playing all this like amazing stuff by, you know, whoever, then you look at your own things and you think, oh, it's not really good enough. But my friend in London, Julian Anderson, we were in touch about some completely different thing. And he said, so have you been writing some music? And I said, yes. And I sent him this piece. And he said, oh, actually, it's absolutely superb. Mm-hmm. So if he thinks it's okay, maybe I should keep going.
But there seems to be something that keeps you going, composing.
Yeah, I didn't do it for years. But then now I think it's... even to just write a one-page piano piece, that's my preferred genre. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I used to think of myself as a composer and not a pianist. And then somehow it changed. And I stopped writing music. But now I think I ought to, because somehow inside me, it's part of me. Mm-hmm. And something that I should do, even if no one cares, you know. Yeah, I'm not looking for approval. although if someone who I respect gives me approval, I think, oh, maybe it's not such a bad idea.
Yeah. Last question. If there's the corona blues, hopefully stops soon. But if bad mood or whatever comes to you and you need some help, some rescue, is there any music that you know that gives you a good mood to play or to listen to?
Yeah, I mean, if I listen to John Coltrane or a lot of these pianists like Ray Brandt, also if I listen to, say, Sly and the Family Stone and George Clinton, it somehow just takes me away from... Because quite often you get bogged down in our, like, European music, and it starts becoming a load you have to bear.
Yeah.
And then if you can just leave that zone and go and listen to someone else's experience, it's somehow... a relief.
Ja, dann sage ich, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Powell, und Dankeschön fürs Zuhören.